This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. We hope you'll stay tuned. Let me take this opportunity to thank Susie Rodefker at the Mainstream Media Project, because she's really been very, very helpful when it comes to getting guests on this program. And she did a really, really cool thing. She helped us to get Frederick A.B. Meyerson on the program, who is director of the Global Change Policy Project at the Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy. And it's really fortuitous that that happened today, because today is the day that the population on the face of the earth reaches 6 billion. Is that correct, Mr. Meyerson?
Well, that's as close as we can estimate.
Right.
Where the Census Bureau actually believed that estimated that the population crossed that threshold back in July, but the UN, which may have been using slightly better data, estimated that the day is today, October 12th.
Let's talk, if we can, first about the Global Change Policy Project and let people know what all you do there, and then we can talk about some population issues and why, when we're talking in terms of 6 billion people, that this is something we really need to be concerned about.
Well, first of all, the project, and more broadly the Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy, looks at large-scale environmental issues like population growth and climate change and loss of biological diversity, and thinks ahead as to what kind of policy we might need, not just in the short run, but over the long term. And most of these issues involve decades and sometimes even centuries. And we really should be thinking in those longer terms instead of just the next political cycle.
Well, certainly that does seem to be the problem, doesn't it? That so much of policy, not only is it short-term and short-sighted, but it's also very often reactive as compared to being proactive.
That's right. And I tell you that now that I have a son, an 18-month-old boy, I think a lot more about what might happen 50 or 70 years in the future, because hopefully he'll still be alive. And I used to do all these projections, and 2050 seemed like something that I'd probably not live to see, but now I realize that I'm working on his future, and I think we should all think that way. What are we building for our children and grandchildren?
Let's say that today is the day that there are 6 billion people on the face of the earth. I mean, can the earth sustain that? I mean, can we sustain a population of 6 billion and a growing population? I mean, where are we at, and where do we need to go?
Well, in some ways, of course, we are sustaining it. Can we sustain it in the long run? That's a more difficult question. We know that there are trade-offs now, and we have a pretty good idea of what those are. One of them is loss of other species. The human race has been very successful at basically changing habitats like rainforests into places that, into things like cornfields that are very productive for us in terms of food. But in the meantime, we're pushing out a lot of species and some of those go extinct. So, and the other thing is, as we use fossil fuels and as we cut down forests, we're beginning to change the climate because of the greenhouse gas emissions. So we're putting more people on the planet, but we now realize we're making these choices, and whether we're changing the long-term viability of our planet to support life is a major question. How many people would be supported if the climate warmed up several degrees and the sea level rose? It's a question that we're doing an experiment. We don't know the end result.
Let me ask you this question, because I will admit publicly on the air that every so often I listen to Rush Limbaugh. And
so do I.
Well, yeah, and there are some people who will forgive me, I hope. I'll talk to them.
I don't like it, but I do.
Yeah, right.
And sometimes it's all you can get in certain parts
of
the
country. Well, it's scary, because actually I was talking with a media analyst one time, and we were talking about the fact that you cannot drive outside the sound of Rush Limbaugh's voice in the continental United States. It can't be done. But that's a whole other issue. The reason why I bring it up is because global warming is a favorite topic on his show, and which I'm sure you're well aware of, and he is constantly trying to say that this isn't happening, that the people who are trying to say it isn't happening, are kind of environmental, crazy, wacko people, blah, blah, you know, blah, blah, what he does. Feminazis, whatever he does. Can you talk a little bit about this? Because, I mean, I think there are a lot of people out in the general public who, I mean, you know, they're good people and they want to do good stuff for themselves and their children and their grandchildren and the planet. And, you know, yet they've got a blowhard like Limbaugh screaming at them 5 days a week, sometimes 6 hours a day on any given radio station, telling them that, oh, this isn't happening, don't worry about it. Can you talk about that?
Well, the climate is warming up. That is the scientific fact. It's been warming up, and particularly in the last few decades. There is no question that we've raised the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels and cutting down forests to a level that has not been around for many, many millions of years. And we're pretty sure that this leads to warming. And I would say that if I had to guess, 80 or 90 or even more percent of climate scientists would say that the human action is warming up the climate. However, there are a few scientists who disagree with that. And, of course, Rush or people like him will certainly find those scientists. They're not the dominant ones, but, you know, sometimes the media makes, I think, a mistake of having to, if there are two sides of an argument, even if 99% agree with one side and 1% agrees with the other, they put an expert on from each side, and it looks a lot more like a 50-50 argument.
It's
a 50-50 argument. Most people think we're warming up the climate, and it's going to, you know, continue to get worse.
Well, it also helps when one side of the scientific debate is funded by the Western Fuels Association and things like that. But those are things that usually don't get mentioned too often.
It is interesting to look at the funding sources for their various points of view.
There's all of these forces that come together to really make it difficult for us to talk about how we might actually talk about planning population. I mean, all the way from religious issues on down. I mean, it's a topic that we have to discuss, and we have to discuss on an international scale. I mean, I think you would agree with that.
Yeah, well, I think you really have to discuss it on all scales, and it is a very personal topic. It deals with, well, the thing that makes us continue as a species, reproduction. And so it's the roots of it are deeply biological for us, and they're social and religious. You have to, though, think that this is an issue which affects you personally in terms of the number of children you decide to have, and it affects you globally because you could be changing the climate, and you can't get away from it. You can't say it's something that's someone else's problem in another part of the world because, first of all, we're the leader of the world, and all the chickens eventually come home to roost here. So, you know, what we can do about it is really be very supportive of family planning programs, of educating people about their choices, their reproductive choices, and giving them as much freedom to make those choices as possible. That's certainly the goal of the UN. The goal of the UN is that every person should have the right and capacity to determine the number and spacing of their children. And unfortunately, hundreds of millions of women in the world today do not have that ability, and hundreds of millions of families.
Talk about why that is.
Well, it's just because we haven't gotten contraception and reproductive health services and education to every part of this planet. And there are some places, still some countries, where the use of contraception is still less than 10% of the population, and those countries have very high growth rates because they're having, on average, 5, 6, or 7 children a family. And when you have that many, if you have 4 children, if everyone has four children, you think you're replacing two people with four children, you're doubling the population every generation. And that's obviously an enormous burden on natural resources and everything else that a country needs to do.
We're talking with Fred Meyerson, director of the Global Change Policy Project. Mr. Meyerson, is it a matter of can't or won't? It seems that Western industrialized countries, primarily led by the United States, are able to export lots of, like, say, guns and genetically engineered things and stuff like that. You know, it would seem to me that certainly if we were to view population as an issue that really needed to be dealt with, that we could be putting the kind of efforts into addressing that we do into, say, addressing arms sales worldwide.
Absolutely, we could. In fact, the UN, the last international population conference was in 1994, and done by the UN, and the United States and 178 other countries came together, and they estimated that in order to bring reproductive health services to everyone on the planet by 2015, the commitment that would have to be made would be $17 billion a year by the year 2000 in the developing world. Of that, a third would come from developed countries. And of that third, about $1 billion should come from the United States. We haven't made that commitment. In fact, our international family planning funding has been cut from $580 million to $385 million. So we're only living up to a third of our commitment. And $1 billion, that's less than $4 a person in the United States, to dramatically change the progression of world population growth and to give everyone the rights that we enjoy here. We spend $1 billion on the most foolish kinds of things every year. I'm sure the budget they're passing right now has some ridiculous things we're buying for $1 billion. And I think $1 billion is probably, we probably spend that every day on arms in the United States.
We're talking with Fred Meyerson, director of the Global Change Policy Project, and we're talking about population. And, of course, today is the day, according to many, that the population on the face of the earth has reached 6 billion. Mr. Meyerson, you were a delegate at that conference in Cairo, correct?
That's right.
Talk a little bit more about that, because I find these things to be really interesting, but I guess the thing that gets me sometimes is that there seems to be a lot of people from around the world who come together to try and address these issues. And then, as you so stated, the countries in the world that really hold the power, the financial power, they just don't follow through on the recommendations that are made at these conferences.
Well, yes, this is unfortunate, and it's because there's such divisiveness, and particularly in our Congress, about some of these issues. The conference itself was extraordinary. I am also on the board of Planned Parenthood here in Connecticut, and I was a member of the Planned Parenthood delegation to Cairo. And one of the most extraordinary things was meeting in a group with representatives of Planned Parenthood affiliates all over, from about 150 countries, and realizing that we were all working on the same very local issues, which is figuring out how, you know, the teenager down the street or someone without the resources that we know in our community was able to decide how many children and when she or he was going to have them. And it was just a marvelous feeling, and it made me realize that we live on a small planet and we need to get together and take care of it. It was a very good conference, but as you say, as often happens, the United States hasn't lived up to the promises it made.
As we're talking about promises being made and not lived up to, I mean, on the one hand, it seems that so much of governmental policy here in the U.S., other countries as well, but since we're here in the U.S., let's focus on that, that certainly much of our national and international policy is based on the wishes, needs, and desires of U.S.-based transnational, transglobal corporations. And I mean, is it just simply let's have lots of people so we can sell them lots of stuff, or what? I mean, don't they get it? I don't understand. I don't understand why people fight against this.
Well, there is a certain fear of anything other than growth. I mean, it's embedded into our economic system. We have Alan Greenspan, who's carefully trying to regulate economic growth in this country so that it falls between 3% and 4%, and some people feel that if the population ever stabilized or even worse declined a little, that that would signal some sort of a disaster. Well, you know, let me ask you: were we so badly off in the 1950s and the 1960s in the United States when we had less than 200 million? Now we've got 270-some million, and the Census Bureau projects we'll be at almost 400 million by 2050. Were we worse off in the 50s and 60s? The idea that more is always better is, you know, one that you have to take a careful look at on a small planet.
I guess for me, the thing that I'm thinking about when you're talking is, I guess, maybe for some people, more is better in the fact that what they have is a big pool of, you know, unemployed people. So that way the rest of the people who have jobs... Or people to buy their products. You have to have a job to be able to have the money to buy the product, I guess.
If you want to have billions and billions of sold, you need to have billions and billions to buy, or something like that.
I think you're right. We're talking with Fred Meyerson, director of the Global Change Policy Project at the Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy. And today is a day, by many experts, that it has come to pass that 6 billion people are on the face of the earth. Mr. Meyerson, one of the other issues regarding population growth, of course, and I think we touched a little bit on this, was the whole issue of religions. And, I mean, certainly there are a lot of people, and certainly I'm thinking in particular of the Catholic Church. I don't want to pick on the Catholic Church, but, you know, that any kind of population control, be it abortion or the pill or whatever, is, you know, really not in favor with the hierarchy of the church. And, you know, that really affects a lot of this as well, correct?
That's right. The Catholic position of the Catholic Church is still that using contraception is a sin. And, of course, abortion is a really, really bad kind of a sin, of mortal or a venial or something like that. I don't know my sins very well. Well, I do, but...
but we probably won't talk about them on the radio today, right?
That's right. But so there you have a position. Now imagine, of course, most people don't really listen to that part of the Catholic Church's dogma. Brazil, for instance, largest Catholic country in the world, but women there have chosen to use contraception. And in fact, they've lowered the birth rate there from 6 to about 6 children per woman to a little more than 2 children per woman just since I started visiting there back in 1970. I worked there for a year for the Secretary of the Environment. And that's extraordinary. So even in a Catholic country, things can happen. But abortion in Brazil is still legal, even though it's available to everyone, but it's not particularly safe. It's illegal. People look the other way, but it's not very safe. You know, hearkening back to the days in the United States before Roe versus Wade, when a lot of people had abortions, but a lot of people died in the process. So it's a thin line, and it's one we have to watch. We have to protect our freedoms in this country very carefully as well.
We're speaking with Fred Meyerson, director of the Global Change Policy Project. Mr. Meyerson, let me ask you, because let's go on the basis that we are on the day of 6 billion. What do we need to do? Where do we go from here?
Well, I think on a personal level, I think look at your impact on the planet. Realize we live on a small planet, and there are probably some things that you're doing that you could do less of. Perhaps you don't need a sport utility vehicle, and you could get something. Try one of those new hybrid cars that gets 60 or 70 miles to the gallon. Definitely support family planning services right around you, you know, Planned Parenthood and other organizations, even in the United States, 43% of all pregnancies are still unintentional or accidental. So we have a lot of work to go here in terms of education and contraception. Support Congress people who are willing to step out and say, yes, the U.S. should be supporting international family planning, because this is an issue that will affect all of us. We cannot separate ourselves from the rest of the world.
We've been speaking with Fred Meyerson, director of the Global Change Policy Project. Mr. Meyerson, two things. If you could give contact information so people could get more involved or get more information, and also if you have any other final thoughts for us this afternoon.
Well, if you want to learn more about this issue, I was involved in the preparation of the UN's annual report called The State of World Population 1999. It was just released a couple of weeks ago. You can access it on their website, which is www.unfpa.org. And that will lead you to a lot of other information, but that report will give you a good idea of some of the issues facing the world. I would also recommend contacting your local Planned Parenthood affiliate if you're interested in giving, you know, your money or time, or the national affiliate, Planned Parenthood Federation of America, and I'm sure you can reach those in your phone book or on the web. Final comments. Here we're still adding 3,000 in this little bit of time that we were talking, another 4,000 to 5,000 people were added to the world's population in this last half hour.
Wow.
Realize that the issue is still happening worldwide. And in the United States, we're still adding about 2.5 or 3 million people per year. These are real issues we should think about. We should think about how those issues are going to impact our children and grandchildren, and start doing some thinking beyond our next purchase and the next small political cycle.
Fred Meyerson, director of the Global Change Policy Project at the Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy. Thank you for being with us today on October 12th, the day that we reach 6 billion people on the face of the earth.
I very much enjoyed it, Mike.
Thank you for being with us. This is Full Logic Reverse. We'll be back in just a few moments. We're joined by David Elliott of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. Mr. Elliott, thank you for being with us on the program.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
Well, we appreciate that you were able to be with us on pretty short notice. I saw a release from the task force that, to sort of sum it up in a title, was more or less 20 dead, 1 year, what's being done. And that really got my interest because I wanted to know more about that. Can you let our listeners know what's happening regarding violence and killing, particularly as it's aimed at gay, lesbian, and transgendered people?
Yes. As your listeners may know, Mike, today is the one-year anniversary of Matthew Shepard's death in Laramie, Wyoming. It's in the news right now, not just because of the one-year mark, but because yesterday the trial of one of the alleged murderers began. Since that time, October 12, 1998, we've seen at minimum, and this is a conservative figure, 20 gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered people murdered across the country as the result of hate crimes. Now, that number could be a whole lot higher. It's just that with some of the murders that have occurred, it's hard to be able to pin down that they were, in fact, hate crimes. It's 20 that we know of. It could be as high as 30, though.
That's a tremendously telling statistic in the fact that all we really have heard about in the national press is Matthew Shepard, but the Matthew Shepards are repeated over and over to the tune of at least 20 in 1 year.
Well, it's true. And, you know, today we remember Matthew Shepard, but we also remember Tracy Thompson, who was killed with a baseball bat in March. And we remember Eamon Bodfish of Orinda, California, who was bludgeoned to death in June. And we remember Sharika Keys of Cleveland, Ohio, who died of blunt trauma to the head just a couple of weeks ago. These are names that didn't get the same amount of attention as, say, Billy Jack Gaither of Alabama or Matthew Shepard. Now, that's certainly nothing to take away from the tremendous tragedy that happened 1 year ago in the Matthew Shepard case, because Matthew Shepard was really responsible, the tragedy, the murder, was really responsible for making this a national debate over what we as a nation can do to end this epidemic of hate crimes. And it's not just against GLBT people. It's also against people of different religions. You know, look at the L.A. Community Center in Los Angeles that was shot up, or look at the church in Fort Worth, Texas that was shot up. It's an epidemic of hate crimes against African Americans, Asian Americans. Look at Joseph Alito in Los Angeles, or look at the shootings in the Chicago suburbs. It's happening all over the place, and we haven't come together and figured out what we're going to do about this.
Well, I guess that leads me to this question. Let me remind listeners that we're talking with David Elliott, who is the communications director for the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. We're talking, obviously, about violence against gay people, but not just gay people, against any number of people. And certainly it does seem that crimes that are motivated because a person is gay or black or Jewish or whatever certainly do appear to be on the rise, or at least coming out in the news much more. What do we do about this, Mr. Elliott?
Well, one thing we can do is pass strong hate crimes laws in all of the states and in Congress. Now, in the past year, we've only seen one state, Missouri, pass a hate crimes law that's inclusive of sexual orientation. Now, two states, California and New Hampshire, have strengthened already existing anti-violence laws, and that was a very good move. But at the same time, hate crimes bills inclusive of sexual orientation failed in 22 states, including Wyoming and Texas, two states where very egregious hate crimes took place. Now, let me bring up the argument that the other side uses in this debate. The other side likes to say that we don't need hate crimes laws because you're penalizing thought and you're setting up a special class of people. Let me respond to that. The issue of culpability has always been a tradition in our criminal justice system. For example, say you back out of your driveway and, Lord forbid, you run over somebody in the street by accident. That's a different crime from, say, premeditated murder. We have first-degree murder. We have second-degree murder. We have manslaughter. Culpability, intent, has always been a tradition of criminal justice and how we punish people for these crimes. So that's our response to the most frequent argument that's brought up against hate crimes legislation.
We're talking with David Elliott, who is with the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. Mr. Elliott, because of time constraints today, we're not going to be able to explore this topic as much as I would like to. I would like to arrange to have you on when we can have you on for a full half-hour segment, if that's possible.
Anytime.
What I'd like to ask you to do, if you would be to leave us with a final thought and also any contact information that you might like to give out.
Well, first of all, I'd like to urge people to register to vote and participate in all of your elections in California. Second, if your audience would like to learn more about the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, I would invite them to visit our website at www.ngltf.org.
David Elliott, Communications Director for the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, thank you for being with us. I'll be back with you to arrange to have you on the show for a more extended piece.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us for this edition of Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. It's been my pleasure to be part of the team bringing you this edition of the program today. If you'd like more information about Full Logic Reverse, you can contact us via email, flr@jps.net, or by phone, 530-265-9462. We invite you to join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.